The Higher Education Workforce Development Budget Division will now be in order. Today's date is Thursday, March 26th. Senator Claussen, good to see you.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Senate File 995.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 995. It's a proposal to support concurrent enrollment courses in Minnesota high schools. Concurrent enrollment or dual enrollment programs allow college-ready high school students the opportunity to take post-secondary courses for high school and college credit. Concurrent enrollment courses are taught in the high school by qualified high school teachers in conjunction with the University of Minnesota and Minsky Institution. There are four main objectives in Senate File 995. The first is to bring adequate funding to support concurrent enrollment programs. Currently, that funding is capped. Secondly, to expand the ability for both high schools and post-secondary institutions to participate. We have some programs that are no longer open because they have topped out on enrollment, so we want to expand those. Third, to provide greater opportunity for teacher staff development. And fourth, to create greater governance and oversight for concurrent enrollment programs. I just wanted to share with you some of the concurrent enrollment numbers in Minnesota. Over 23,000 students participated in concurrent enrollment courses in 2013. 16% of those students were from low-income families, and that's a 41% increase over the last 6 years. 10% of the students were from minority populations, and that's a 51% increase from 2007. And during the 2013-2014 school year, high school students around Minnesota earned over 208,000 credits in over 59,000 concurrent enrollment courses offered by local high schools in partnership with 27 University of Minnesota and Minsky institutions. The committee previously heard Senate File 997 in the Policy Committee, and rather than repeat sections of the bill you're familiar with, I'll just focus on some of the amendments. And this is our fifth stop with the bill, so there have been some amendments along the way. So I'd like to turn attention to sections 4, 5, 6, and 7. Section 4 requires post-secondary institutions offering concurrent enrollment programs and are members of the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnership to report student evaluation surveys to the Office of Higher Education, the Department of Education, and the legislature. Post-secondary institutions that are not members of NACEPT are also required to conduct evaluation surveys and report results to the Office of Higher Education, Department of Education, and once again, the legislature. And NACEPT is the accrediting national organization. Section 5 requires post-secondary institutions offering concurrent enrollment programs to develop an advisory board to engage stakeholders in concurrent enrollment decisions. Section 6 requires post-secondary institutions to be accredited by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnership by the 2020-2021 academic year. And Section 7 stipulates concurrent enrollment advisory board membership terms.
Excuse me, Senator Claussen, some of us are looking at it. We should be working off the committee engrossment.
Oh, yes, that is correct. So we have had all of the earlier amendments dealing with secondary, or E12, have been taken out of the bill.
Right.
So the section numbers you're saying are probably not accurate.
Right, exactly.
I'm looking at the four sections above.
Senator Claussen, Mr. Kornacki just gave you the.
These are the four sections that are just above the allocation. So it would be section 4, section 3.
And let the record reflect there is a quorum.
Yeah, it would be section 2, 3, and 4 that I've been references here.
Okay, thank you.
You have a number of handouts that have been given you, and this provides good documentation. A couple that I'd just like to turn attention to. There's one from the University of Minnesota College and the Schools program. And there's two things there. One is a credit recognition document that indicates the transferability of the credits that are earned in the college and the schools program. And then also there's a one-year and five-year student survey results reflecting requirements found in the sections of the bill that we just went through. And we have with us, as you can see, a number of testifiers, so I would like to begin. Who would like to begin?
Senator Claussen, before we go to your testifiers, can you just answer the question of why is it that you're recommending an advisory council at each post-secondary institution? And if the testifiers will be addressing that, you don't need to answer it, but if they aren't?
I can, Madam Chair, I would just go back to my own personal experience of serving on the advisory council at the University of Minnesota College in the Schools program. It provides insights, and as a board member, you can direct your thoughts and have input into the direction of courses. So I think it's a very worthwhile that we have that input and then establish that relationship between the secondary and post-secondary institutions.
And Senator Claussen, do you see any way to be able to combine some of these councils rather than having each individual institution have it to get shared learning, or you think that it should be each institution?
Madam Chair, because each of the 27 institutions that currently offer concurrent enrollment that are post-secondary institutions, because each one has their own program, and there are different secondary schools that are involved with each one, I would recommend that we have one for each institution. That would not preclude, however, that they could get together and share information, so I think that's a good suggestion.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Chair Bonoff, committee members, guests, my name is Kent Hansen. I'm president of Anoka Ramsey Community College and Anoka Technical College. We have a very robust concurrent enrollment program, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak about the great things that we have going on at Anoka Ramsey and Anoka Tech. First point I would like to make about concurrent enrollment is that the success of the program depends on very strong relationships. They need to be deep and enduring and very significant partnerships with the schools. You can't just dabble in concurrent enrollment. I think the advisory board is one way to make sure that that happens. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of scope for our work at Anoka Ramsey, we have 12 concurrent enrollment partners, most notably the Irondale and Moundsview partners that have the early college model, where students can attain an AA degree at the school, while at the same time getting their high school diploma. We serve approximately 2,000 students in our concurrent enrollment, and that number has increased significantly, 25% in the last year alone, as we look to expand our relationships with our school districts. Anoka Ramsey has been delivering concurrent enrollment since 1987. We've been proud to help other schools and colleges work on their concurrent enrollment programs, most notably our partner here, the Buffalo School District and North Hennepin Community College. We've been giving advice and counsel to other colleges. One thing that we're proud of is a new consortium that we're developing with the Centennial School District, Columbia Heights, Ridley, Moundsview, Roseville, Spring Lake Park Schools to have more consistency in the delivery of concurrent enrollment and also leverage the strengths that each school district have in the offerings so that, for example, the lower enrolled areas we can collaborate together to deliver. Most recently, Anoka Ramsey Community College has given the good seal stamp of approval by the Higher Learning Commission, as we had the Irondale, Moundsview, and Cambridge-Isani sites approved for full delivery. And just to give you an example of some of the things they talked about, the collaboration that Anoka Ramsey has with partner high schools, also the commitment to the benefits of concurrent enrollment, The strong support from the college, curriculum oversight that assures quality and rigor, and I know that question comes up occasionally, and that's really how we come around making sure that that's there, is the excellent faculty that we have that work with the excellent faculty at the school districts and the partnership together to make sure that that's there. And also the teachers in the school districts noted the collaboration between higher education districts and the teachers provided for professional development opportunities. In your packet, I believe that you have a document from Jobs for the Future. This is an outfit out of Texas that the Minnesota State Colleges and University System has been working with. And I would like to point out a couple of pieces of data that they found. Most notably, so when we think about the impact of concurrent enrollment, the Jobs for the Future found that students who take dual enrollment courses are 2.2 times more likely to enroll in 2 or 4 year colleges in Texas. The persistence, they're 2 times more likely to be enrolled in the second year. And probably one of the biggest things is they're 1.7 more times likely than those that did not take concurrent courses to complete their degree. And completion for degree is a very important piece to what we are concerned with. Related to this, noted that the Irondale High School, since the inception of the concurrent enrollment partnership with Anoka Ramsey, has a 92% rate where students continue on to higher education. And we're very proud of that relationship with Irondale Schools. As Anoka Ramsey works with different school districts, we've identified, as well as Dr. Vargas from Jobs in the Future, that 12 credits seems to be a tipping point. And so that's a very important number to help students be successful in colleges. And one other point about the Irondale model that we're very proud of is the Irondale early college model also addresses the achievement gap. Irondale has had a 39% increase in students of color taking college level classes. So at Anoka Ramsey, we're very proud of our relationship with our school district. We look to expand this program, and I want to assure you that this is a partnership between the school district and the college, and a meaningful partnership based on success.
Thank you very much, President Hansen. And I attended the Irondale event when Secretary Duncan came, and that was very, very powerful. So I was just going to ask, how, in terms of the advisory council, is that something you currently do?
But based on the strength of our partnership, we get together regularly. But we are definitely interested in something like that, and it's a natural evolution to the work that we're doing.
Thanks. Okay, next.
Okay. Chair Bonhoff, members of the committee, I'm Larry Lundblad, president of Central Lakes College. And I'll answer your question on the committee. We have a large committee, almost identical to what's proposed in the legislation. And part of that is because we're a NAICP certified or accredited institution. And one of the requirements for the NAICP accreditation is that you have the advisory committee. And we found it to be very beneficial. Superintendents, principals, faculty, counselors, they give good advice and help to give direction to the college and the school's program. Like Anoka Ramsey, Central Lakes has a large college and the school's program. We work with over 30 high schools in the area. Last year we had 1,800 students taking concurrent courses. And concurrent is especially important for rural districts. Small rural districts struggle to make options available for their students. Concurrent enrollment is an option that we can work with them to provide their students. A lot of our rural districts are an hour or more away from a college or a university, so if the students want to take advantage of PSEO, where they're going on site, the college site, to get the college classes, it does leave out the students that probably could benefit the most. If you're a family or if you don't have a car or you don't have the gas to get to the university or college, you're left out. So concurrent enrollment really plays an important part in the rural part of the state in helping us to serve the students of that area. Some advantages to concurrent, beside being on the college or on the high school campus, it provides a good environment for the students to get started. And many of our students in our area, especially our first-generation students, where there's really not a history of college in the family. And so having the experience through concurrent where they learn the rigor, not only the content material, but the rigor of the courses, they learn how to manage their time, and they get acquainted with college culture, if you will, so that they're college-ready, so that when they're ready for the next step. And we track our students very closely in terms of outcomes and that type of thing. Last year, 83% of graduating high school seniors in our region, and we serve a large seven-county region, continued the college after their high school graduation. That was 792 out of 954 students. 508 attended a four-year institution, 283 a two-year college, 169 at a private institution. Many of them are going on to careers in education, engineering, and the like. One of the exciting things about this bill is that it also focuses on broadening concurrent to include career and technical. I met with 18 superintendents here a few weeks ago, and to a person, they're all looking for ways to better serve career and technical students that are interested in career and technical courses. So the legislation is timely. The rigor, as Dr. Hansen pointed out, is a constant concern, and it's something that's continually raised as, well, how can you be delivering college courses in the high school? And we monitor that very carefully. Each of our disciplines do assessments. Students that are taking English, for example, they collect writing samples from students, concurrent students, and our on-campus students and online students. The concurrent students typically perform the best. Our psychology department, concurrent and on-campus, offer the same final examination. There's no significant difference between the performance at the high school with concurrent students and our students on campus. The legislation really does provide, it's a solid piece of legislation, allowing more funding for schools to offer concurrent enrollment to expand, opens the door to students who are interested in career and technical education options, provides resource for professional development, which is extremely important, and then, of course, establishes clear expectations for rigor. I'd like to conclude with just two comments from two concurrent students. Kirsten, who is was a concurrent enrollment student, graduated with 41 college credits. She's now a junior at Concordia College in Moorhead. She writes, "The CIS program, which is our concurrent program, prepared me for the rigor of courses at Concordia. They were a great stepping stone. The courses through CLC expanded my capacity for learning and helped me determine a career path." Kyle, who is a current high school senior and enrolled in concurrent courses at, through Central Lakes, said, "I have discovered what it takes to have responsibility for my education. CIS sets me up for success, not only academically, but for all aspects of my life. It is important for me to prepare myself to be successful after high school. What better way to prepare myself than CIS?" So I really applaud the efforts that have gone into this bill, putting this bill together, and urge your support.
Thank you. And Senator Claussen, we heard this in policy, and so the members, I do think, are supporters. What I would ask for the other testifiers, and if we could focus our efforts on the fiscal implications, what the actual fiscal impact would be used for, and if you would just keep your remarks succinct. Thank you. And I appreciate that your testimony, and I do think you make a great case for its importance, but I want you to know we're sold. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Mark Mischke. I'm the principal at Buffalo High School, and I think so that clarifies my role this afternoon of what you'd like to cover, and I think the document I gave you actually, hopefully you'll hit the mark on that. There's a purple document that was handed out prior to us sitting down here today, and it has two pieces to it. On the front side of the document, there's six bullet points that really highlight what I'd say is the essence of what I'd want to accomplish today in our conversations, and a brief history of Buffalo High School as far as enrollment and CIS course options. And on the other side of the paper, it gets to your point, Madam Chair, about the financial benefits for not only Buffalo High School, but obviously you could overlay this with schools throughout the state of Minnesota. And so I'll hop back and forth quickly, but I'll focus primarily on the financial benefits and where I see that happening at our school. And so, one, in terms of the financial benefits, and I'll start with a mini story of a student and walk into this. The student's name's Eric Anderson. He's a senior at our building right now. Was a BC student who was in my office because he was naughty and had a ton of potential. We hooked him up with our AVID program at our high school, which is obviously, if you're aware, is a college preparatory coursework. And then he, in turn, his senior and junior and senior year, participated in the CIS course options, CIS chemistry, CIS writing at the U of M. He has since moved forward to graduate with honors this spring, has a full scholarship to the University of Minnesota Duluth in chemical engineering. And he is a prime example of an anecdotal story, but a financial benefit to what you were talking about earlier. Eric would not have gone to college. He does not have the financial means to leave our building for PSEO options, nor would he have had the drive or the ability and background to know that he could be successful at UMD. So the concurrent enrollment courses for him allowed him to be successful and hopefully is going to be very successful as a chemical engineer at the UMD. So, but that leads to kind of a broader brush for students in our building and also students throughout the state. If you flip over to the financial side, we as a school district, as you can see, our partnerships are with three different colleges, U of M, Southwest, and St. Cloud State. And we as a school district roughly allocate about $100,000 a year to cover tuition costs for our concurrent enrollment options. But if you look at just the financial benefits for the community members at Buffalo, Hanover, Montrose, it's $1.5 million over the last 2 years in free tuition that our students are benefiting from, and in turn our families are benefiting from. And the likelihood of our students then entering college both better prepared and financially able to carry out those 4 years is quite evident in the savings that they make in just the 1 or 2 years they're seeing at our high school. So, and then bridging the gap to that next step, the other financial benefits are the partnerships that both Anoka Ramsey and CLC has talked about. And we're moving into a partnership with Hennepin Technical College and North Hennepin Community College, modeling very similar to what Anoka Ramsey did. And so the financial support that you would provide for a school such as Buffalo High School would allow us to partner both on a technical end and on a North Hennepin Community College end and bring coursework for every department within our building in college-level coursework. So in the industrial tech area, arts, facts, IT, along with our core course areas, our partnerships with the professors at these colleges and the financial backing will allow us to go on site, observe what's happening at Hennepin Tech, watch what their programs look like, learn from them, participate in a year-long mentorship program so that college professors feel secure and confident that our high school staff are going to be able to deliver the curriculum appropriately so that students can step out and be well-prepared, not only for general coursework but also specific coursework in those colleges. And so that upfront allocation for dollars to provide those mentorship opportunities will pay off benefits, not only just in tuition and credits, but also in better prepared professors, both at a high school level and a college level, in terms of delivering the curriculum.
Thank you. And Senator Claussen, could you address how the high schools within the confines of this bill would gain access to those dollars, and what would be the process for them to get those dollars? And because you've got two different things that we're looking at providing an appropriation. One is to develop new concurrent enrollment courses. So I assume that money is going directly to the post-secondary institutions.
That's correct, madam.
And then these the expansion grants. So the money that we're hearing about for Buffalo would be coming out of a Department of Ed appropriation.
Madam Chair, it would probably be a combination because there would be some costs at the post-secondary level as well to do some expansion of courses, and there would be some costs for the post-secondary or the secondary institution. So that's why we have two appropriations. You're just looking at the post-secondary here, but the other side of the bill has the secondary appropriations.
So, Senator Claussen, what is the $1 million in each year by us?
And you're referencing, sure, which part of the?
Page 4.
Right now, Madam Chair, we have secondary schools that cannot access courses because they're full. And so what we're looking is providing some dollars to the post-secondary institutions so they have the capacity to expand those courses. I'll give you an example. At the University of Minnesota, College Lit is kind of a base course. That course is closed right now. They don't have the capacity to expand that so that other schools can come in. So we want to provide some dollars so that the post-secondary institutions can expand not only current course offerings that are in demand, but look at new offerings as well.
So, you know, I don't expect you to have all these answers today, but I think as we look at our overall bill, you know, I'd like us to understand where does this $1 million, where do we come up with that? Who is asking for it? What exactly would it be used for? Because when I see just like a round number like that, it seems to me that it's more just throwing a number against the wall rather than from the bottom up, building a request that comes from what you exactly know that the money needs. So now that we've moved into the fiscal bills, I think that's what we want to be looking at, really, sure. So that we can have a laser-like focus on what our dollars are going to go for.
Madam Chair, just a brief history of the fall. I visited 15 secondary schools. In fact, both sides are Shakopee and Buffalo were two that I visited. I also visited post-secondary institutions. And in those conversations, we talked about what are your needs? What can we do to expand the program? And so these dollar amounts are from those visits with various institutions.
Thank you. So last testifier.
Chair Bonoff and members of the committee, my name is Ben Cush. I'm the principal of, as Senator Klassen mentioned, of Shakopee High School. And I'll paint kind of the Shakopee picture, you know, similar to what Principal Mischke spoke about. Shakopee High School, we're a high school about 1,550 students in a 10-12 facility that bumps up to about 2,200 if you include our ninth graders. And so our largest partner from a concurrent enrollment standpoint is the University of Minnesota and their College in the Schools program. And so, you know, the fiscal end of things as it pertains to that partnership with 2013-2014 data looks like this. So we have we have 12 teachers at the high school that teach 12 College in the Schools courses. To about 606 students, and that's a double count number because some students take more than one class. That comes to us at the district at a cost of about $87,870. The state portion of that currently takes care of about $25,000 to $30,000 of that, meaning that there is about $60,000 to $65,000 that is owed on the part of the district. You know, something that my colleagues here have both mentioned, you know, just the value that this provides to our families. Last year alone for Shakopee was about $1.1 million in terms of credit hours earned. In pragmatics, what that looks like and how that helps us at the high school is $60,000 is about a teacher, for a little bit of context. What this legislation would allow for us to do, as Principal Mischke talked about, programs such as AVID. You know, we have like many of my colleagues in the state, we've got a wide variety of abilities, needs, wants, and aspirations. And so what this legislation allows us to do is to repurpose that money so that we can provide, you know, students that need more help, we're able to provide more help. Students that don't need as much help, perhaps, we're able to provide programming. Either way, in the end, we're able to utilize those dollars to get every kid where he or she wants to be. Because, you know, our goal, I'll speak to our goals and aspirations at Shakopee, you know, we're interested in providing a challenging, a relevant, and a personalized learning experience for each of our kids. And one of the greatest ways that we can do that is to continue to add to the tools that we have in our toolbox. Concurrent enrollment programs, whether it's through CIS at the University of Minnesota. We similarly work with Normandale Community College down in Shakopee, and I have some background in working with, like my colleague, Mr. Mischke with St. Cloud State University. You know, either way, it's all about providing more opportunities for more students, and freeing up our general fund dollars allows us to do just that.
And I would ask either of the principals, Mr. Mischke or Mr. Bush, do you find that the formula hurts you in terms of is there a disincentive to have those kids be in other, you know, programs? Well, I guess concurrent enrollment is different because you get to keep them in your building versus, you know, when they have to go off campus. So do you have an incentive in that way to keep them in that, or do you more look at whatever's best?
I think I'd go with the latter. I think my experience, and this is, you know, obviously it's it's a personal piece. But as I look at the success that students experience, you know, personally and anecdotally in the 10 years that I've been doing this, the success that I see kind of broad brush from a concurrent enrollment experience is one. It's far greater than just a straight up PSEO. Mm-hmm. Now that's going to vary to be sure, and it's going to vary sometimes to the student. But when I look at some of the prior comments about what a better environment is there to try on college when. You know, I know in our school, and I'm sure in Mark's school, you know, every kid's got seven adults that care about them and want to see them be successful every day. And if you expand that to teacher, to counselors and administrators, you know, what a better place to be supportive, try something different, challenge yourself, stretch yourself, and that's exactly what concurrent enrollment does. PSEO is a little bit of a different animal.
Thank you.
Hope that helps.
Just a brief add-on to that, Madam Chair and committee members. The one thing we've done is North Hennepin Community College has a satellite program at our high school at night. So they teach courses there, college courses there, and then also a high percentage of our PSEO students that we do have attend North Hennepin. And so we've actually reached out to North Hennepin and sat down with them and said, when are our students successful? When are they not? You know, so, for example, some that have dropped out or failed out of PSEO and then come back to us deficient in credit. We've tried to study that situation along with our students that are successful, and that's really lent to a productive conversation with North Hennepin to say, here's how we can be successful collaboratively and more comprehensively. So kind of stealing the best of both worlds and what happens well in PSEO and concurrent enrollment. So I see the benefits that moving forward of that as well.
Senator Pratt, and members who are not on E-12, I just noted by seeing that Senator Nelson had a question. There was a bill that had pieces of it on this original bill that the K-12 division was funding, where money went to MDE to expand this. And then there was a portion of Senator Claussen's bill where money went to Office of Higher Ed to expand the institution's role in it. And so we, in E-12 this morning, separated those two and brought those that related to the post-secondary to this committee. So that's why you're not hearing and seeing before you the aspects that expanded it through MDE investment. And that's why I was asking those questions about what do our dollars do? And so that's where all that was coming from. Yeah. Senator Pratt first. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cush, you talked about an amount over $87,000 that was coming out of the school budget. And so maybe to follow up on that, Senator Claussen, is that something that schools are getting funded for, or is Shakopee having to cross-subsidize that? And then how are you spending those funds? What is it going to? What are you having to cross-subsidize?
I can say this, but this is last year. So for the 13-14 school year, fiscal year 14, the per pupil charge for the University of Minnesota is $145. Fiscal year 14 subsidized from the state $40 per student, which left $105 for the high school to pick up. All right, so that's the split. That's that $50,000 to $60,000. What's that? I'm sorry.
$5 per student.
$105.
Oh, $105.
$105 per student times 606 students, and so that $60,000 that came out of the general fund, as we look ahead. So that answers that portion of your question. Looking ahead, I think Principal Mischke brought up a great point about something called the AVID program. That's something that that kind of programming, that kind of support, is what freeing up the general fund allows us to address. How do we make concurrent enrollment courses I would say more challenging courses, whether it's an IB program, whether it's AP, making those accessible to more students, and not just making them accessible to more students, but ensuring that those students are successful as well.
Madam Chair, just one comment. In making the rounds around the state, I should mention that Senator Nelson attended the meeting in the Rochester schools, and Senator Pratt and I were together in the Shakopee schools. So we had other
members. Great. Thank you. Senator Nelson?
Senator Kent. Senator Kent attended as well.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm quite relieved to know that the rest of this good bill is sitting in K-12.
Yes.
As I walked in late, I went to Mr. Fuller to get my amendment ready to put back the good things that we co-sponsored. So
right.
I appreciate the fact that they're still in play. And I just wanted to mention and add my voice of support to this bill in its entirety because of the impact that it plays in students' completion of high school and college completion. And particularly, I'm sure it's in your packet here, the information regarding, interestingly enough, at-risk students, those very students that we're so concerned about. But as you said, we're already sold on the idea, Madam Chair, and so I won't go any further. But I'm wondering if Senator Claussen, just for the record, could talk about the impact of dual enrollment on college completion. I don't know if you were able to touch that yet.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nelson, there's been research that's been done on that, and they show that students that take college in the schools courses are twice as likely to pursue a post-secondary education. They're also twice as likely to graduate from a post-secondary institution. And I think one of our speakers here mentioned if a student has that foundation, I think of 12 credits, the possibility or probability of them graduating with a degree is just overwhelming in the evidence provided, so it's good. And just another comment, Senator Bonoff, about the $1 million. It's difficult for me to identify where that's going. I know what it's going to be used for, but it really is up to the Office of Higher Education to identify those programs that are currently closed that need to be expanded, and also provide some funding for some thinking, where do we want to go from here? What are some expansion, especially since we've added the CTE courses,
mm-hmm.
because that's a new wrinkle onto this, and we're going to need some dollars to get that going as well.
Very good. Well, thank you. And obviously, members around this table are strong supporters, so thanks for bringing it forward. So with that, we'll move to we'll lay this on the table for possible inclusion.
And Senator Botta, thank you. And just one last comment. We were all high school principals. They still are. And if you look at my hair, this is what they can look for.
Well, thank you for your leadership. Those of you in the schools, we really appreciate it. And thank you to your leadership in the colleges, too.
Thank you very much.
So next we have Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1153. This is a proposal that establishes a merit-based academic excellence grant program. Madam Chair, everyone in this room is dedicated to improving our high education system merit-based student awards and in resolving what I consider to be a debt crisis for our youth and students in college. Senate File 1153 establishes that merit-based grant program for Minnesota residents attending a four-year Minnesota public high education institution. These grants, called High Achieving Minnesota Grants, you ready for the acronym? HAM, would cover the cost of tuition and fees less any federal Pell or state grants for which a student is eligible. There are 2 points, Madam Chair, that I want to put out on this table, and then I want to bring up a third point later on discussing about how we could maybe expand this to look at our other institutions in the state of Minnesota. But first of all, the first point is the GPA throughout Minnesota students are eligible if they're pursuing a four-year degree, earn a 3.5 and a 25 composite ACT score, and then have a family-adjusted income of less than $100,000. In addition, Madam Chair, the student must enroll in the Minnesota Public Higher Education Institution to receive the grant. The grants can be renewed each year by applying through the Office of Higher Education, and renewal is contingent upon continued residency, satisfactory academic progress, and recommendation by the institution. This initiative is based on the Georgia HOPE Scholarship, which has provided scholarships and later grants to high-achieving high school and college residents, Georgia resident students since 1992. At the start of the HOPE program, the scholarships covered a student's tuition, fees, and book allowance. The entirety of that program is funded through the Georgia State Lottery and costs as much as $748 million in 2010 and 2011, providing awards to over 256,000 students. Last year, the awards totaled $533 million for 199,000 students. There is a fiscal note for this implementation of the High Achieving Minnesota Grant Program. It should be in your packet. Adopting this proposal would cost $100 million for the biennium. The Office of Higher Ed estimates that the total of 10,142 students would be eligible to receive the grants, with Minsky students receiving an average of $3,684 and the University of Minnesota students receiving an average unmet need of $6,430. Those 10,142 students then would participate in that grant program. The HAM grant program would also require a one FTE full-time equivalent at a cost of $100,000 for administration. I believe that this program is a right step, a positive step in improving our education system and resolving the student debt crisis that we've all started talking about this year, while establishing that Minnesota is a leader in post-high school affordability, and at the same time encouraging young people to continue their education and careers in Minnesota. And part of that continued conversation, Madam Chair, is perhaps looking at the inclusion of other students. Our Minnesota Association of Private College Students perhaps should be brought into this equation as well. We just talked briefly last night about that, and I know it's short notice on that, but I just wanted to make sure, Madam Chair, that is also worthy of a discussion as well. So I think it's time we start looking at a bold objective to these commitments to our youth within colleges, and I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, I like this bill. I had a bill very similar just a couple of years ago. The Georgia program is very successful because they have a huge amount of money. And they have a corpus that they can provide these grants based on interest payments generated out of the fund.
Yep.
We don't have that in the state of Minnesota. So what you're proposing here is a general fund allocation that would continue every single year to do this. And I for one, am very supportive of merit-based scholarships, but I am concerned that your bill is too limited when you talk about four-year degree programs and not necessarily technical schools. We have a real need to encourage students to go to technical colleges and to go get two-year degrees. And I think just focusing on four-year degree programs, I understand you need to limit the amount of students that qualify for this, but I would really like to see those two-year students qualify for this and those technical programs as well. I also see in your bill the grade point average of 3.5 or higher. Again, I know that's to limit the number of students that qualify. But I think if we're going to have a merit-based scholarship program, more students should qualify. And I know you're trying to balance those interests there. I would just ask you to take that into consideration. I'd really like to see those two-year and technical students qualify for these merit-based programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Ortman. Yeah, that was every point you brought up exactly was talked about, and it was about, you know, the gap that's missing was this one right here. But absolutely, I'd be willing to work with you in the future again, as you brought it 2 years ago. So it was 2 years ago. So thank you.
Senator Ortman.
And Madam Chair, I was trying to find that source of funds that would be continuing. And so at the time we talked about the Viking Stadium, because it has a source of revenues that are dedicated to it that eventually won't be needed. So we couldn't, as a function of state financial responsibilities, we couldn't end the commitment to the Viking Stadium, but once the Viking Stadium is fully funded, there are some continuing sources of revenues that could be dedicated. But I think the best way to do this, if we can, is to find that large sum of money that continues, like the lottery fund or funds that are being dedicated to the Viking Stadium, rather than just a general fund allocation. I support it.
Thank you.
I just think we we should either fully commit to this or not. And I know you always find yourself in this place, well, will you take a little? And I say, yes, take a little, Senator Hoffman, but see what you can do to expand it as soon as you can.
Senator Pratt. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, did you say $100 million?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, yeah, I did.
Okay. Madam Chair, is this an informational hearing?
Yes. No. Senator Peterson, I'm not a co-author on the bill.
Okay. So, I'll leave my friend Senator Hoffman alone for the rest of the hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Hoffman, the House author did bring it to me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we really are working very hard to expand our state grant program. And so that's where my own focus has been. But I do appreciate the distinction and how important it is to look at merit-based scholarship. So thank you.
Go ahead.
Follow up.
Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just so, since we're having the discussion, a couple of concerns that I guess I would have is I do think the level of crisis with student debt I think is a debatable subject in and of itself, but I do also see this bill. I think it's important to encourage academic achievement without a doubt. I do see some problems with the sort. I mean, number one, I think the type of student that we're looking at here is a student that is on the right track. They're probably going to be just fine in life if they continue on the trajectory that they're on. And thus, there are going to be inherent types of students that receive the lion's share of this sort of grant program, and most likely they're the type of student that I again would say are most likely going to be doing just fine in their post-secondary experience, and so that would be one of the concerns that I have is that there's a number of students that maybe isn't as certain that they're going to get through the process and maybe don't have as much of the means to provide for a post-secondary experience. And so those are just a couple of the things that I would point out, and we could have a more lengthy conversation about those points, but that's just kind of on the surface one of the issues that I see with the approach. Thanks.
Thanks. Senator Nelson?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just be very brief. Some of my comments were actually have already been expressed, but one had to do about the interplay between this and the state grant program. And so you can contemplate that a moment, but it is true that as a general fund allocation, my thoughts would be along the state grant program as well, because in a sense, this could be if this money were appropriated to this merit-based grant program, it could also go to the state grant program. And so because we don't have that pot of money that can be dedicated on an ongoing source, it is competition for general fund dollars. And to echo Senator Peterson, certainly merit-based scholarships are essential, but there are many merit-based scholarships for students that are qualified, who meet these qualifications here. They already have a lot of options available to them. So my suggestion would be twofold. One, focus on the state grant program. Two, look for that large funding where the interest only could come out of a corpus to fund scholarships like this. And could be something like the Minnesota Promise. There are states that actually fund scholarships for every student that graduates from high school from that state has the ability to go to a two-year college, to a career and tech college on the Iowa Promise or the North Iowa Promise, whichever it is. And so I think there are ways to address this, but I'm not sure that I'm totally in support of using the general fund dollars in this way.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. You're raising some great points, and that is, you know, Senator Peterson, you're right. The credit debt problem exists. Anecdotally, We have folks that come into our agency and they're $60,000, $70,000 in credit card debt because, and they're in that class of middle class that are just, they're on the right way, but it's costing them, and then they're getting behind. And you're seeing that trending. You also saw that through some credit reports that were out there nationally. So I think that is a whole separate issue, and let's work on that as well. I love the conversation about expanding, and I like the idea of the state grant piece. My hope for this was to get this information out there, and so that, you know, I would like it possibly laid over just to keep that conversation going. I know, you know, a budget's a budget's a budget when people start saying that, but this is really important work that I think needs to be talked about, and it's right in line with where this body has gone, especially when you look at the state grants, and I appreciate the time to bring this forward to you, Senator, and I would like it to be just laid over for possible inclusion.
Absolutely. Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I will move that, but I just want to say I think the best reason for doing this bill and making this kind of a commitment isn't necessarily to reward good students. It's rather, if you can make it broad enough in terms of its application, you can raise the educational level of the entire state. That's what was so amazing about what happened in Georgia and in these other states. So many people were able to take advantage of programs that weren't otherwise in existence to help them get to that next level of education, that their economies improved because we had so much more education, we had more skills, which was why I was so interested in the technical side of this as well. But I think that's the reason for doing it. You can profoundly change the state's future and its economic development by educating more people. That's the exciting part about it, and I hope you'll keep working on it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. So absolutely it'll be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Next, we have Senator Dahl, Senate File 1817.
Madam Chair, members, thanks for having us today. I don't actually, in my 6 years around here, I'm not sure I've been in front of the Higher Ed Committee, but...
Welcome, Senator
but,
Dahl.
But that's surprising to me anyway. But I have Senate File 1817, and I'll let my testifiers, a couple of Carleton students from Carleton College, obviously in Northfield, explain their thoughts, because they actually came up with the idea. I know in education we've talked a lot about the need for ag educators and young people to get into farming or ag research and so forth. So, you know, they put together some ideas and actually gave the ideas to Representative Bly, and he threw it at the reviser, and he came up with an idea for a bill. So Senate File 1817 establishes a young farmer summer seminar and practicum, and I do have an A2 amendment, if I could have someone move that for our first stop here.
Senator Claussen moves the A2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And what this does is not $100 million, but more like $100,000 for each year of the biennium, where the Commissioner of Higher Ed could, in working with our institutions of higher learning, in connection with an organization, and I'm just throwing one out there that expressed interest, like the Land Stewardship Project, would set up a program that would have participating students complete at least 2 days per week on average of coursework in animal science, soil science, ecology, environmental science, horticulture, plant biology, political science, and then they would have to complete internships at participating farms. So that's the simple version of what we're trying to accomplish. I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers. You didn't know that Carleton students sat around and thinking about how they could get their hands dirty out on a farm, but I'm going to turn it over first to Robert Harris. He's a sophomore at Carleton College, and I'll let him testify.
Mr. Harris, our some of us actually went to Carleton during our tour around the state and really had a wonderful visit. So we did a town hall meeting with students.
Great. So,
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having me here today to testify. My name is Robert Harris III. I'm a sophomore undergraduate student at Carleton College, and I'm here to represent the Heart of the Heartland Young Farmers Summer Seminar as co-founder. I, in conjunction with another Carleton student, Sarah Goldman, who is also here today, helped to draft the bill being presented today. The bill is a product of the document that we have provided you all. It's the document that says the Heart of the Heartland, and it's an overview of our program structure. Our program seeks to place undergraduate students into summer internships throughout Minnesota on small-scale farms. The program also contains multiple seminars. Seminars will focus on agricultural biology as well as political science. The overall goal of the program is to produce students that can think from an interdisciplinary perspective, not only about agricultural topics and issues, but also within the broader context of knowledge itself. The way society organizes knowledge today is very disjointed, and I believe that no longer do we live in a world where a biologist can think only like a biologist or an economist can think only like an economist, but rather that to approach complex topics, it's necessary to think from the perspectives of many fields. For example, the three pillars of our program are biology, political science, and hands-on farming techniques. Our program will attempt to show students that the three are not mutually exclusive, nor do they exist in a bubble separate from one another, but rather that each field is the product of many interactions with other fields. We intend to implement this pedagogical innovation in a number of ways. First and foremost, neither of the three pillars, biology, political science, or practical experience, will take precedence over the other. Each field is a necessary component of the machine that we call agriculture. In addition to the foundational components of our program, we are exploring the idea of incorporating a number of other fields. Farming in itself is a culture composed of complex relationship webs. We're also exploring the idea of conducting experimental research to solidify some of the theory covered in biology seminars. Conducting hands-on research has been paramount in my own education. I have conducted plant research for several summers at the Chicago Botanic Gardens, as well as Carleton. And science is actually a field that has found me by accident. As a high school student, I signed up for an environmental science course because the original course that I wanted was field, and I immediately fell in love with the material in the course. And later, it compelled me to apply to a summer program in environmental science with the Chicago Botanic Gardens. And the research that I experience that I gained there solidified science as a passion of mine. The bridging of theory and practice that Heart of the Heartland Young Farmers Summer Seminar embodies can spark the same passion in many other students that it has instilled in me. Ultimately, Heart of the Heartland seeks to produce individuals who can critically and effectively think not only about topics and issues in agriculture, but also be able to operate in an ever-evolving and complex world. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I also have with me Sarah Goldman from Carleton as well.
Madam Chair, committee members, guests, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Sarah Goldman, and I'm a sophomore at Carleton College also. I'm a potential environmental studies and sociology anthropology double major. Before speaking about the specifics of the bill, I'd like to reflect just for a moment about what it means that I'm here to speak to you today. I'm not a farmer, I'm not a politician, and I'm not a college administrator. I'm a student. I'm a college student. And I can say confidently that to have me speak here is to have faith in us as students, to believe that we can direct our own education when we have dedicated mentors supporting us. I and many fellow young people who have initiated and worked on this project know that this pilot program is the direction that best serves our development as students. And with the help of organizations like the Land Stewardship Project, we know that this legislation will be successful. And I hope that you, too, will have faith in this vision. While the program this bill aims to create is not too complex, it's pretty simple. You can look at in the program overview. It's new and it is innovative. So I ask that you take a moment to consider how this program could shape higher education in our state. The mission of the bill is to ally young people with farmers, giving them the tools that they need to shape agricultural policy, biology, and sustainable farming practices. The program is based on three pretty simple principles. The first is that farms can serve as classrooms. Farms can inspire intellectual curiosity. The second is that hands-on learning and formal academics are both important and complementary aspects of a comprehensive education. And the third is that Minnesota has a rich agricultural heritage that is changing, and young people, students like me and Robert, need to be able to adapt to these changes. I'm going to talk a little bit about my experiences on farms now. For me, interning on small farms has been an instrumental part of my education. In Northfield this past year, I volunteered on Seeds Farm with Becca Carlson, a local farmer, and I planted veggies in the spring and weeded in harvest in the fall. And while working on this farm, I was interviewed by the soil and the biology and the prairie that I encountered every day. And I also wondered all the time if the vegetables that I were growing were accessible to low-income residents. To truly value higher education is to recognize the unconventional classroom that farms could inspire intellectual curiosity. Personally, I also decided to attend Carleton and in Minnesota because I love farming, and I've always been really interested in agriculture, and Minnesota is known as the heartland. What a better place to go to school if you're interested in agriculture. But in order to train and prepare the future generation of Minnesotan farmers, students need a more interdisciplinary and multifaceted understanding of land stewardship in this ever-changing agricultural landscape. Students need to understand, for example, how microbes affect soil composition and biogeochemical cycling. They need to be able to understand why and how crop insurance is structured and how it's likely to change in the future and what mechanisms are leading to pollinator colony collapse. This program would provide such an education. In summary, the Young Farmers Summer Seminar and Practicum Program will give us college students the academic basis that we need to understand our rich agricultural environment. And also, they'll give us the opportunity to engage with this environment in new and novel ways. I hope that you'll have a minute to look at the program overview. We worked hard on creating that document. And feel free to ask us any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the testifiers? Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Is the program overview legislated, or is this just an example of potential program, because I'm looking in the bill and I didn't see anything about the items that you mentioned, and so maybe I'm missing a document, but you provided an example of a program overview.
Yeah, if I would respond to that question to the madam chair, you're
okay,
correct.
Just checking.
It would just be an example.
Yep. And then one follow-up question.
Senator Nelson.
For Senator Dahl. Senator Dahl, have you worked with the Farm Bureau or the Farmers Union or Marl or University of Minnesota Extension, any of these agricultural programs that we already have in the state? Is this in conjunction, or you worked in with any of them?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, no, I've visited with all of those organizations, pretty much all of those, and they've talked about the need and how they would like to see the next generation of young people, get into farming or go into agriculture or ag research and so forth. So I would hope that they also would be one of those organizations in collaboration with the higher ed, as it outlines here, that would be able to access the dollars that we're trying to do here to set up a program.
Senator Nelson.
Comment, Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Dahl, you're right, like Marl is one such program that actually develops, I think it's Minnesota Agricultural Rural Leaders. And so we have a number of these programs that are, I think, already in place. And I appreciate the extra attention that the students have brought to the need about better connecting people with their food. And so thank you so much.
Senator Dahl, as we look at the request for the appropriation, at first it was a blank appropriation, and then you, in your amendment, you're requesting $100,000. I appreciate the distinction between $100 million and $100,000. That was good. But can you tell us what exactly the $100,000 would be used for, and is it scalable? If you had less than that, would you be able to have a program?
Madam Chair, I know the students are contemplating those types of questions, and they were kind of stressing out a little bit about what kind of dollar amount to put in there, but our testifier could give a little more insight on what she was thinking.
Madam Chair, thanks for the question. We were anticipating this question. We're in the process right now of creating a feasibility study. This is a really new idea and program that we're creating. We're working with organizations such as the Land Stewardship Project. They have a similar program for college graduates called the Beginning Farmers Program. And we're also working with the Carleton Center for Community and Civic Engagement to talk about what would a comprehensive budget look like. Right now, we know that for each student in the program, it would be a minimum of $5,000 to participate, based solely on the fact that we need to provide transportation, room and board, and also pay any professors who are going to teach for those seminars. And so with that assumption, if we have at minimum 20 students, which we're anticipating would be the low minimum, then we need $100,000. So that's how we reached that number. We don't have a comprehensive budget yet.
Senator Dahl, Ms. Goldberg, thank you very much for that. And you might consider having partnerships. There might be some interest, you know, on behalf of the farming community to contribute too, but you're certainly have requested a conservative amount. So, but we would be interested in seeing actually the financial plan. And I was just wondering if both of you could just comment, what are your career ambitions?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a plant biologist. It's what I've done from the very beginning. I've worked in plant genetics as well as economic botany with the Chicago Botanic Gardens. And this past summer, I've worked in ecology with Professor Carlton. And then I'm also going to be working in ecology and landscape ecology at Kansas State University this upcoming summer. So,
wow.
Grad school research is where I'm headed.
Thank you. That's great. Ms. Goldman?
For me, I think one of the best parts of being a college student is you don't have to know exactly what you're going to do. So I would say I don't know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm interested in agriculture. That might look like becoming a farmer. I thought a lot about that. Maybe working in policy, like farm policy. But I think to do that, you also need to be a farmer for a little bit. So probably being a farmer after college.
We need more women farmers.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any other questions for Senator Dawes or anyone else who would like to testify in this bill? So with that, we'll lay this over. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Last bill, Senator Dzitzik. And we saw Dean Burr was in the audience, and I'm sure he appreciated hearing about the proposal.
$18.81. Good afternoon, members, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1881. This bill is requesting funding for the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center. The center was created at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus to research and develop effective measures to prevent and minimize the threats posed by the invasive plants and pests in order to protect Minnesota's natural resources and economy. The invasive plants and pests are diverse and cost Minnesota approximately $3 billion per year. They cause environmental harm and economic harm to our forests and crops. Some examples of the pests include the emerald ash borer, which has the potential to destroy 998 million ash trees in Minnesota. Here is a bug. This is the emerald ash borer. And I think you have a handout in your packet, and this is on the corner right here. This is what these bugs do, and this is what kills the plant. In my neighborhood in southeast Minneapolis, they are destroying the plants, and they're destroying the trees, and so Minneapolis is actually cutting down a bunch of the trees, so it hopes to stop it from spreading. If it spreads, I think it's on our western, it's on the Duluth border, and so it's right up there by the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, and so, you know, imagine the devastation if it gets into the Boundary Waters Canoe Area or on the western border where a lot of the ash trees are. You know, what impacts will that have on our water, on the economy, and on the forest? So I don't know if anybody wants to look at this little bug. You can pass it around if you do. But we get these all the time in the environment and LCCMR committee, but I don't think you guys see them. So we'll share the bug.
Thanks, Andy.
Some of the other bugs that in the last that they would be researching that impact our economy are the brown marmorated stink bug, and I've been told that this bug does stink when stepped on, and it eats and damages fruits and vegetables, and the mountain pine beetle, which would kill 191 million pine trees in Minnesota. The center would work closely with our nonprofit and for-profit sectors, other government entities, and other educational research organizations. It is meant to be a collaborative effort to bring together the experts to find options and solutions. Members, the legislature last year gave the University of Minnesota approximately $4.8 million to get this effort started. This additional funding will allow them to do more research. With me today to discuss the center and the request and answer any questions are Dr. Robert Bennett, thank you, a research biologist with the USDA Forest Service and adjunct professor at the U, and he's the new director of the center. And then also here today is Dean of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resources Science. And with that, I will turn it over to them.
Thank you.
Chair Boniff, Senator Dezik, thank you very much, and thank you, members. I'll just be brief. Senator Dezik did a nice job of describing what some of the challenges were. And one of the issues is that invasive species cut across not only rural landscape.
Just state your name for the record.
Sorry. I'm Dean Brian Boer, Dean of the College of Food and Agricultural Natural Resource Sciences. And just to carry on with where Senator Dezik left off, these species cut across urban boundaries. So, for example, everlast borer, there are many ash trees in the urban environment. They cut across agricultural lands, forested lands, wetlands, intersections with native prairies, and so on. So they're really broadly across the state, and the economic impacts of that $3 billion are real. One of the things that the College of Food, Agriculture, Natural Resource Sciences brings to this is a very diverse set of researchers to address this section between insects, microbials, and other pests that occur, including animal pests, for example. So as part of our program with the Terrestrial Invasive Plants and Pest Center is we cut across entomology, forest resources, we cut across horticultural sciences, applied economics to look at the economics of where we make the investments of funds to address invasive species. Includes agronomy, bioengineering, looking at mechanical controls, for example, across this. And so we bring a very holistic scientific approach to how do we address invasive species across the palette of issues in Minnesota, which makes us fairly unique. As part of the program, as we put it together last year, we were very inclusive with working with state agencies, so the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Minnesota DNR are part of the programs we're working on to do this. And we're working with University of Minnesota Extension, the College of Biological Sciences, so we bring a very broad set of resources and capabilities to address the invasive species issues in Minnesota. We're also located, we have 10 research and outreach centers across the state. And one of the aspects of that is those research and outreach centers. One, for example, is in Cloquet Forest Research Center, is in northeast Minnesota, and primarily addressing issues, for example, the western pine beetle when you're in that part of the country. And we have the research on the landscape to be able to do that there. You go to southwest Minnesota with Lamberton, and we can work, for example, on native prairie issues and how we're addressing invasive weeds, like leafy spurge, for example, in native prairie areas. So we address that full portfolio of where those needs are at across the state. As Senator Dezik said, last year we were fortunate. The legislature, and thank the legislature for that, we received $3.4 million in general funds to begin to develop the center. Along with that, we've worked, and LCCMR has been a tremendous partner with us, the Legislative Citizens Committee on Minnesota's Resources, and they we've submitted proposals and had funding from there for $1.46 million in last year's legislation, and now a request pending this year through LCCMR for another $5 million. And I'll put our original request last year when this came forward was about $15 million, and that's basically looking at, in some of the conversation earlier today, we're modularizing this because to address the various invasive species. And we're very sensitive to this issue of these are difficult challenges and looking at both mitigation, prevention, and removal. But what we want to do is assure that we spend those dollars effectively in addressing, you know, where are the greatest needs and where can we have the most impact. And so you could have an invasive that's established, very difficult to stop or prevent. We look towards mitigation and spending dollars that way. In cases where there may be prevention, the western pine beetle, for example, that's not yet here, can we invest those dollars on prevention that might be more effective? So trying to cut across those activities to create a portfolio of actions that are both responsible environmental natural resource-wise and economy-wise, but looking at how we spend and invest these dollars. In July 2015, we did develop work plans to move ahead with this. In September, we searched for a director. And in January 2015, we were very fortunate to have Dr. Rob Vinette become the first director of the investor of invasive terrestrial plants and pests center. We need to shorten up that name a little bit so I can say it, saying all that all at once. Just a bit of background on Dr. Vinette. He probably won't be this boastful of himself because he is Minnesotan now, of course. He's a research biologist with USDA Forest Service, and he's an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota. His expertise is in biocontrol of insect pests and forest systems, ecological impacts, detection and mitigation, and risk assessment. So if you could write a person into this area, it would be Dr. Vinette. He's worked on it for years and has been tremendously successful. He's had almost $10 million in grants, 66 peer-reviewed articles, over 200 presentations. So this engagement issue of how do you get communities and others engaged in addressing these issues, he's stellar in performing that as well, drawing together different partnerships. And he supervised 29 grad students. And I'll just point out, as we put this together last year, we really wanted to emphasize the education component of this, since we're in the higher ed committee. And a lot of the work we've structured around is to bring graduate students into these areas, the idea being not only to do the research, so at least half of our funding is going directly to graduate students, to do the research, but to generate that next generation, these young students just testifying a moment ago that were coming to PhD programs, the next generation of people to address, you know, the biocontrol issues related to invasive species. And we heard from DNR, MDA, and other areas that we simply don't have enough people working in these fields to have an effective impact. So we're trying to multiply that out through generations and training as well. And with that, Chair Bonif, I'll hand over to Dr. Vinette to make a few comments about where we're heading in the future with this now.
Just a couple of questions before we do that.
Sure.
Thank you. So we would like to see where the funds that we've given you in the last biennium have been spent. And so if you don't have that with you, that's fine, but we would like to see it.
Okay.
And then in addition, you mentioned that you received funds from LCCMR.
Correct.
We know that last time the funds that you got came out of Senator Tomasoni's committee. Originally, you know, it was environmental appropriation in the House last session. Looks like, Senator Dzitzik, you're requesting this from this budget. Is that
it's from the general fund, so.
And it says appropriated from the general fund to the Board of Regents, which generally means comes from here. And so it was not part of the university's request. Mm-hmm. And generally, that's how, when we look at what the university's budget requests are, we go with that, although what I've learned in my short stint here is that then things get funded in other departments, but if you could just speak to those two questions.
We did get the funding last year from a combination of, it started in the House, and it came out of, I believe it was actually leftover LCCMR money, if I am correct. Yes, we had leftover LCCMR money, and so that money goes through Senator Tomasoni's committee, and so that's how that came about, the $4.5 million there. They have an additional request right now before LCCMR, and then again the original packet that they came up with, the proposal was $15 million, and so that's where that is. And I don't believe it is one of the U's top requests, but I do believe they understand the importance of it and the collaboration effort, and as you said, the teaching effort. So it's, you know, not their top priority.
Senator Dzitzik, it wasn't in their budget request. It wasn't lowest on their. It just wasn't in it.
No,
so,
I know.
Thank you.
I think they are supportive of this effort, though, because they understand. There also is a 2015 legislative report, and so we will get you all copies of that. That gives the, and I'm sure this was LCCMR through Senator Tomasoni, but it does lay out what has been done so far, and in the LCCMR plan of where the money is going, so we'll make sure that you get all of that.
Senator Dzitzik, do you know how much money is left not appropriated yet? Because the funding was identified as available for use until 2022. And for, it sounds like your new, of course, your new executive director would know that. So
yeah.
Go ahead. I think that's your cue, Dr.
Thank you.
Vinette.
Yeah, may I introduce myself?
I'm
Dr. Robert Vinette, and I'm with the University of Minnesota, and I'm with MITPAC. That's the easier way to say this very long acronym. And I'll tell you, the original plan for the spending of the funds was to be for the salary of the director. This was the original plan from the college. But there has been an amazing turn of events, and that is that the Forest Service, who is my current employer, has made an in-kind contribution. So my entire salary as director of the facility is being paid by the Forest Service. So that's amounting to about a $60,000 a year savings for this program. The additional funds will be paid for an associate director, and we are nearing the final selection of that individual. And then we will be launching very aggressively into our research program. We've been very cautious, though, that we do not want to make haphazard judgments about what is an appropriate line of research. As Brian mentioned, we are trying to structure a very thoughtful yet prompt evaluation of the needs for research in this state, and that is a two-part process. First, it's looking at what are the greatest threats to Minnesota, and that's across the board. This is all lands. So we're thinking about our natural resources, our wetlands, our forests, as well as agriculture and our urban environments. But the second component of that is also thinking about where can we have the biggest impact with our research. And so there are certain invasive issues, certain invasive organisms, weeds that have been here for a very long time that it seems very difficult to believe that we would make much of a dent. That's not true for some new invading species that are showing up in the state, things like oriental bittersweet, which is just now found just in the metro in the southeastern part of Minnesota. We have a tremendous opportunity to make a huge difference, but we know so little about the biology of that weed that we're very uncertain about how to proceed. So at this point, I will say very little of the funds have actually been committed, but we do have plans for spending those funds very promptly.
So, Director Vanette, the close to $5 million that was appropriated in the last biennium,
correct.
Most of that has not yet been appropriated.
To individual projects
right.
or personnel, that's correct.
And so in terms of requesting an additional $5 million, what would be the most pressing reason why that would be your request today?
Madam Chair, to meet the needs of the state, we clearly need a $15 million allocation total. The challenge that we face is a serious opportunity cost. And so if we do not have the funds available, we will not be able to fund the research in a prompt manner. And because these invasive species issues are so dynamic, they're changing, these things are spreading across the landscape, that delays our ability to provide information to the state agencies, to industry, to be responding in a prompt and proper way. And so what we're talking about right now is if we have that additional $5 million, we can fund at least an additional 3 to 5 research projects. A typical research project will cost on the order of about $210,000 a year. The majority of that funding is going to support graduate students and postdocs, over 75% of that funding. And because that's part of the mission of the university and where we see the greatest value for our investment.
Thank you. Senator Cicek?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding, and they'll correct me if I'm wrong, but when we did the aquatic invasive species, a lot of the conversation was around, and we asked these similar questions in LCCMR on why do you know you've got this money sitting there, why do you need more? And part of it is, again, as you said, you need the flexibility to have rapid response to deal with some of these issues, but also to get the top-notch graduate students and post-op docs to come in and work on this and to commit to this and be there. They aren't going to commit to this, you know, when they've got your top-notch students have multiple jobs or attracting them to come here and to get that research. If they have multiple opportunities, if this one is only going to be, well, we think the money will only last 6 months and they've got another opportunity that is, you know, guaranteed a year or is, you know, full-time employment someplace, they're going to weigh and balance that. So they do need to have some stability there to say that this is a commitment, and we understand from that this is a commitment to the state that we have these issues that we want. It's a $3 billion a year hit to the state on some of these impacts, and that is before you get to and lose all those trees. And what is again on that western border, if all those ash trees are gone, how is that going to impact the water there? How is that going to impact all sorts of things? And so they kind of need to have some money there so that they can bring in the right people and have flexibility to bring in the right people, but then also make a commitment to those person that, we're not just going to have, you're not going to have a job for a month and the funding's gone. So
thank you.
My understanding.
Very good. Good job. Okay. So with that, there are no further questions. Nobody else would like to testify on behalf of this bill. We will lay it over. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, members, have a